Yeah, am I coming through okay, Dave?
You are coming through great, Randy. So let me give you a quick update, Randy, while you were getting ready. We have people from around the world. Literally the furthest I heard was somebody from Brisbane, Australia. And I know you've got a lot of fans in Australia. And I also had people sharing what they like most about Randy Gage. I thought I might get some good ideas for introducing you. I heard things like tough love, smart, caring, sharing was one of the biggies that one lady said. So you got a lot of fans on. Most of them know you well. But if you don't know Randy, here's a couple things that I think is special about Randy. A lot of people talk about prosperity thinking, but I think Randy is one of the world's number one experts on prosperity thinking. I know for me, he's on my personal team to help me always be stretching my mind with regard to prosperity thinking. As I mentioned, I'm honored to have been asked to review his new book. It is out of sight great. And what I liked about that book is it stretched my thinking. What I'm looking forward to tonight in tonight's teleseminar is Randy stretching my thinking. A lot of people don't realize Randy is one of the most caring and giving people. Not a person who wears it on his sleeve, makes a big deal about it, but the money he gives to charities, the support he gives to charities, and the support he gives to his friends is one of the things I treasure about him. So it is my great pleasure to introduce you to my friend and a guy I have enormous respect for, Randy Gage.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Thank you so much. That was Dave Carpenter, if anyone got on late and didn't know, the kind of coach to the stars, Dave Carpenter. So thanks very much for that intro. All right, guys, I'm going to jump into this because I don't know if I'll have time to do another one of these before the book comes out, and I just want to squeeze in as much as I can. Here's what I would tell you. I'm going to set the table with a couple of things that I mentioned on the first one of these, but because I've got at least, I don't know, 500 or 600 people who weren't on the first one, according to the email service. So I want to just kind of set the stage for what we're going to talk about and how we're going to talk about it, and then I want to get into some new material about wealth-creating strategies that we didn't have time to talk about last time, the first time around in the teleseminar. So, couple of orders of business. If you were not on the first teleseminar, after we hang up, go ahead. You can. I put it up so you can replay it. And I'll tell you the same thing for that one as I'm going to tell you for tonight. If you can't get 3, 4, 5 multi-million dollar ideas out of this next hour, you're just not paying attention. Or maybe even multi-billion dollar. I mean, seriously, no hype, no rah-rah. That's what I'm talking about. These the issues that we're talking about, they're so lucrative. The opportunities are so breathtaking. I want you to really be cognizant of that. So I really mean that. Listen, if you didn't catch the first one, we put it up. You want to jot this down. The site is called riskyisthenewsafe.com. riskyisthenewsafe.com. And that's got the video, why I wrote the book, and there's a comment section. But look on the right-hand side, right top corner, you'll see the first teleseminar, and you can replay that anytime you want. That's hosted up there. Also keep in mind, this is I'm really making a mashup. Nobody's ever done this before, but I thought, you know, the book's about technology and social media, and we're talking about those things. So I thought, well, let's utilize it. So this really is a mashup teleseminar / Twitter chat, and the hashtag to use is #RINS, RINS, R-I-N-S, which of course stands for Risk is the New Safe. So I'm going to be monitoring that hashtag during the whole conference, so if something comes to mind, you've got a question, I'll try to get to as many as I can, or just comment, see anything you're thinking about what's going on in the talk, you know, that there's a whole, we got a couple thousand people from around the world on. And these are amazing people. I know personally at least a couple dozen of the people that I've seen in the Twitter stream and whatever that are going to be on. And some of these people are just flat out brilliant. So there's a great community to mastermind with just on this Twitter tag, Twitter chat using that hashtag, #RINS. One of the other things I said last time we did this was that for, and I said this probably five times today on five different radio interviews. Excuse me. I said for most people, the opportunity of a lifetime, the opportunity of a lifetime comes around about every 3 weeks. So what do I mean by that? I do mean that, honestly. The opportunity of a lifetime for most people comes around about every 3 weeks, but they don't recognize it because they don't have the right mindset. And this is the confession I have to make. If you would have come to me 15 years ago, 20 years ago, with the idea for Google, for Yahoo, for Twitter, for Facebook, for Microsoft, for the iPhone, for the iPad, any one of those multi-billion dollar ideas, if you would have come to me with any of those, I could have given you chapter and verse on why they didn't work, why they would never work. And last time we did this, I was relating a story about, you know, when I first heard about CNN, the idea from Ted Turner, when I first heard about ESPN, when ABC was launching that, I thought those ideas were crazy because that's where my consciousness was, especially 20, 25 years ago, before I really began this study of prosperity. And I just, whatever idea you brought to me, I could give you all the rational, logical, empirical evidence ideas on why they wouldn't work. And because I believed that, because I had that mindset, that's what I manifested. That's what, so when you don't have that, and there's a chapter in the book where I really get into this, where you've got to have the mindset to recognize opportunities when they come about. And I'm not kidding when I say we're going to run through some rapid-fire ones on this teleseminar chat tonight. And just don't think of it like a mastermind session, a brainstorming session. Don't argue. Don't debate it. Don't just take in any ideas. Even if they seem just crazy to you, be willing to explore them. Be willing to be a critical thinker. Be willing to process them. And then again, if you can, you go out, you do your critical analysis, you do your critical thinking. If you think the idea, hey, that's just a crazy idea, that won't work for me, fine. I don't have any problem with that. But I want you to at least consider it. So keep that in mind. Here's the premise of the book, the premise of everything we're going to talk about. Cataclysmic change. And we're going to look at a lot of different areas that has happened. Last week we talked about what's happening with the euro collapsing, governments going bankrupt, how mobile is changing everything. We looked at cloning. We looked at biogenetic engineering, virtual reality, the information overload that people are experiencing. All of those things are cataclysmic changes that are taking place in our society right now. And those cataclysmic changes equal breathtaking opportunities, because every cataclysmic change first leads to a challenge, and challenges are where those breathtaking opportunities are. Because understand, some of the greatest wealth in human history was created in the Great Depression. And doesn't matter, I know we've got people from countries all around the world. Go to any one of them, look at their economic history, look at their times of depression and or recession, and you will see that's times that wealth was created. Because during times of recession, whether the dot-com bubble is bursting, where the real estate market is going down, whether the stock market is crashing, whether there's up or down in precious metals or currencies, any of these things, unemployment in big sectors, certain industries that are in downturns, wherever you see a challenge, there's a corresponding opportunity. And the bigger the challenge, the bigger the opportunities. So let's talk about some of them. These are just some of the things that I explored in the book, and I want us to just think about, and again, just be cooking these around now in your conscious mind, later in your subconscious mind, and just let them percolate and ask, you know, what are, because here's the advice I give to anybody I'd be coaching, is look for people who have problems. Find a way to make their problem go away. And they were joyfully, lovingly, gratefully crawl naked over broken glass and throw money at you. And the price is irrelevant. You will find when you solve people's problems, when you become, my friend Joe Calloway talks about becoming a category of one. One of the things we look at in the book is the branding issue and how social media changes branding, how the fact that everybody can communicate, that you can commune direct with your tribe through your Facebook page and your YouTube channel and your Twitter account and all that, how that changes all the dynamics, right? But just know, we have all these avenues to connect with our tribe, with our people, with our customers, with our followers, with our constituents, depending on what it is you do. And there's all these tremendous opportunities to know what are the things keeping people awake at night. You say, okay, I'm opening a new business in such and such field. How do I get new clients? The first question I'm going to ask is, what are the three things that keeps your potential clients awake at night? If you can tell me what those three things are, I can show you how to get anyone and all of those clients. Because if you could show them how to make those three things or those five things that keep you awake at night, man, they don't care what you charge. They don't care whether you have a high school degree or a college degree. They don't care about your credentials. They don't care about anything. All they care about is the solution you can provide them. And I got to tell you, you know, as a consultant, I've been working as a consultant for 20 years now. And I don't even take a contract that isn't $1 million. And understand, I'm going up against multi-million dollars, and in many cases, multi-billion dollar consulting companies. And they come in and they bring 15 people and they do a proposal. They write a proposal for companies. And, you know, they might be 60, 80, 150 pages. They might spend $50,000 on the bid process, flying in all these people, and they have a dog and pony show, and they have, you know, all these charts and graphs and PowerPoint presentation. And I walk out of there with a contract. Here I am, a high school dropout who was expelled. And, you know, I'm walking away with million-dollar-plus contracts, beating out these sometimes billion-dollar companies, and I have never done a proposal. In fact, I refuse to do a proposal. And when they always say, well, can you send us a proposal? And I say, no, sorry, I don't do proposals. They say, well, how do we hire you? I say, it's very simple. Write a check. So what I do, let's say I'm going in and I'm doing an operation overview with someone and they want to talk to me. Particularly, you know, this is something I'm kind of formalizing when this book, Risky is the New Safe, comes out. I'm going to create like a two-day overview for companies where we'll come in and we'll really look and predict the future for the field or the market that they're in. And I just want the top level people. And I'm going to charge like $125,000 for that, for a two-day thing. Just me, 2 days, no dog and pony show, it's $125,000. And then if they like that and they want to hire me, it'd be $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, whatever the contract is. And I will never do a proposal. But I can tell you what I've been doing for 15 or 20 years. If somebody's interested, I say, come on, meet with me. They come to the office. We sit down. I say, tell me what's going on in your company. Tell me what's going on in your business. What are the problems you have? And I sit and listen, and I take notes. Okay. We got the problem with this. Oh, we have a problem with that. Oh, we have a problem. So I just listen. I listen. Then, you know, it's usually lunchtime. We order lunch. They're still, oh, and then the issue is this, and then the problem is that, and we're losing market share to this, and here's the problem. We don't know how to deal with that, and we got personality thing with these people, and, you know, the regulatory issues with that. And I just listen. Sometimes it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon before they finish telling me all their problems. And then I always say the same thing. I say, you got problems. Fortunately, I can help. And of course, I only say this if I can really help. I got to know what their issues are. But it's almost always the case of I have the expertise to help them make those problems go away. So I say, here's what your problems are. Let's just summarize. Here's what you told me. Your problems are bop, 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 bop. Here's how I would solve those problems. It would do bop, 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 and I'll read them through the list. And then they'll say, okay, how much will that cost? And I say, a lot. And I say, well, a lot? How much is a lot? I say, a lot. I say, well, okay, seriously, how much is a lot? And I quote them a figure right there. I just pull it out of my pocket, whatever, and I might say, okay, it's a $100,000 initiation fee, $25,000 a month retainer, this percentage of increase in sales or this percentage of profits or whatever. I will come up with some sexy compensation that, you know, incentivizes me to want to work with them and rewards me in relation to the results that I can produce for them. And then they'll say, well, great, can you send us a proposal? I say, no, I don't do proposals. I just told you what I'll do. If you're interested, you got to write a check. And 9 times out of 10, I will walk out of there with a check, or they'll have a check FedEx to me within a day or two. And, you know, 1 out of 10, they say, well, no, we really need a proposal run by the committee. I say, you know what? Sounds like it's not a good match for us. So what's the point? Why am I telling you all this? Because nobody cares about the fact that I'm a high school dropout. Nobody cares that I don't have any college degrees. Nobody cares how old I am. Nobody cares what political party I am. Nobody cares what side of the railroad tracks I was, you know, raised on. What they care about is, can this guy make our problems go away? And based on the conversation that I have with them during that day, they usually determine, you know what? This guy can do what he says. This guy can make our problems go away. And that's a lot of money. We've never really paid that much for a consultant before, and we've never done it without a proposal before, but this is the way he operates. He's one of a kind. There's nobody else like him. I think he's the only guy in the world who can do what he does. Let's hire him. That's that category of one that Joe Calloway talks about in his amazing book of the same name. You create that by solving people's problems. All of these things, and risky is the new safe, that's the whole approach of the book. We look at, and here's the other thing, I'll just kind of back up and review something I said last week. You'll find it helpful to read a book by Dan Burris, along with John David Mann. It's called Flash Foresight. And there's a couple of things about trends that he mentioned in the book, and it's really helpful to you. The first is the difference between hard trends and soft trends. So a soft trend might be that, you know, there's a hot band right now, or there's a hot song on the radio right now, you know, Call Me Maybe. Everybody's doing Call Me Maybe spoofs and parodies right now, right? I think it's Katy Perry, although I'm not sure whoever sang that song. So there was a video, and now there's a bunch of people who have done videos. So if you track those and you put them in a chart, you'd say, wow, within 10 years, there'll be 10 million people doing Call Me Maybe videos. But that's not really going to happen because that's a soft trend. Other things are hard trends. Something like the baby boomers, as they have progressed from their 20s to their 30s to their 40s to their 50s, 60s, that's a hard trend. That's something that you can bank on, you can take to the bank. The other difference, and this is very important to be discerning about this, is something that's a cyclical trend versus something that's a linear trend. A cyclical trend might be the price of currency against other currencies, might be real estate or land values in a certain area. They're cyclical. Sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. Then there's linear trends, like broadband. The trend of broadband to be more accessible to more population around the world, that's a linear trend. It's only going to go in one direction. The cost of broadband, it's going to continue to get cheaper to the point where it's virtually irrelevant. It won't even be worth metering. That's a linear trend. So the idea that I took from Dan's book, which I'm really applying in all of these other economic areas and trends and markets and business situations, is knowing about the difference of those trends, you can, with an uncanny degree of accuracy, predict the future. And Mark, listen to this now. Listen to me carefully. If you can predict the future, you can predict the problems. If you can predict the problems, you can get rich. Why? Because what we said, you can find a way to make people's problems go away. They don't care about anything but how much money do they have to pay you to make them go away right now. So let's go back to the book, some of the things I mentioned here, and some of the that'll just bring some fascinating, really difficult challenges, which of course are going to offer those breathtaking opportunities. I mentioned that most of the people on this teleseminar, last time I said, and tonight, will have the opportunity to take a vacation on the moon. You'll have an opportunity to buy a home on the floor of the ocean, and you'll be able to sing a duet with Elvis Presley, although that last one will be done probably in a virtual reality holosuite. This is not woo-woo stuff. This is not 30-year, 50-year, 100-year in the future stuff. We're talking about stuff this decade. So that takes us to some interesting questions. What's going to happen when we colonize the moon? At some point, I mean, most of the people on this teleseminar will be able to take a vacation on the moon. That means somebody will be up there with a resort, and that you'll be visiting that resort. Now, where are they going to put that resort? Where are they going to decide the land is, and how much land is theirs? They're going to go, and they're going to be settlers. They're going to stake their territory, just like they did here in the wild, wild west in the United States, right? So people are going to get, they took their stagecoaches and they went across west, and then there was this land which was, and then you had governments and you had states who sometimes land, and they controlled the land, and they say this land belongs to this state and the state owns it. We're going to sell it to people who want to live here. Other states say, well, you know, we're going to give away the land for free because we want people to settle here. So we're going to give it that. Well, how does that happen on the moon? How did that happen on Earth? Because we can look at the United States, we can look at Europe, we can look at Africa, we can look at South America, and we can see, you know what? There were some really, really messy situations. Because there were people that said, we've got these 500 square miles here, or this 10,000 square acres here, and somebody next door said, well, we've got those 10,000 square acres here, and we also have 3,000 of those square acres that you say are yours are actually ours. So you know what? Let's fight about it. And they send armies in. And a lot of times, the boundaries of geography were determined by bloodshed, by marauders, by conquerors, by war, by really messy things where people get dead. What prevents that from happening on the moon? If you can help solve that problem, you could be one of the richest people in the universe. So we've got the Google boys partnering with James Cameron right now, and they've got a company called Interplanetary Resources. If you remember the last time we did this, I mentioned the fact that they've created this company to mine asteroids. And I talked about how this is going to affect the precious metals market. Because one of the things I say in the book is I'm predicting the euro will collapse within 2 years, and this is going to, of course, have a waterfall effect on the dollar, the pound, the yen, the peso, all currency around the world, and it's also going to have a big effect on precious metals like gold and silver and platinum. And you take gold, which is, what, $1,500 an ounce, the last time I checked mine, that could go to $10,000 an ounce if there was a real worldwide panic when the euro collapses, as there ultimately will be. Now, I'm not saying it's going to go to $10,000 an ounce or it's going to stay to $10,000 an ounce, but I'm just saying it's very conceivable that could happen. It could go to $15,000 an ounce for gold, let's say. Now, what's going to happen, of course, is when Interplanetary Resources and other companies start to mine asteroids, there will become a point where it's cheaper to bring precious metals back to Earth than it is to take them out of Earth. So we talked about that the last time we did this. But here's the other question. Who owns the asteroids? They're just out there flying around. They're light years from Earth, some of them. They're thousands of hours from Earth. they're not in anybody's map. They're not, you know what I mean? And so the Google boys go up there and they say, we like that one. That one looks like it's got a lot of silver in it. So we're going to start mining that one. Well, who owns that? Who claims that? How do we adjudicate that? So you say, well, we create a, you know, we have the United Nations, and they settle disputes like in Africa when there's two warring neighbors and the UN sends in peacekeeping forces and whatever. Well, how does that apply on the moon? How does that apply on these asteroids? How does that apply when the time comes, and that time is not that far away, when there will be a habitable planet within space travel distance from our planet? And we will start to, people will start to migrate on that planet. And then again, they colonize that planet. Who owns the planet? Who owns the land? Who splits that up? Now take, you know, let's look at something else we discussed last week. Wow, sales lead U.S. Marine Corps is telling me gold has already hit $1,750 today. That's good news. I must have made I made a lot of money today. Really, $1,750. That's great. So one of the things I mentioned is, you know, ocean floor property. As I told you last time, there's already a hotel in the South Pacific that has this biosphere room that goes down. You're literally on the floor of the ocean, and the sharks are swimming by, and the octopus and the fish, and you got the coral reef garden in front of you, and all that. Well, who owns the floor of the ocean? What does that do to your property value? I'm in Miami Beach. I'm right on Biscayne Bay. I'm on a condo overlooking the marina. So my condo is worth, like the condo that I live in is worth probably $300,000 more than the condo across the hall from me. Why? Because my view looks over Biscayne Bay and the Miami skyline. Their view looks over the public supermarket. So, but what happens to my ocean front, which isn't really ocean front, it's bay front, but what happens to the lakefront land, what happens to the ocean front land when we're now selling ocean floor land? And again, who owns it? So you look at these things, and you've got governments who say, well, we kind of have this international agreement that it's 12 miles from our shore is our territory. Our Navy defends us there. Our Coast Guard defends us there. This is our country's waters, and we control that. Really? Well, there's other countries who say, no, we control 200 miles from our continent. You can look at what's going on with Japan and Korea right now, arguing over some island out there. You can look at the Las Malvinas that the UK and Argentina were going to war at a few years back and still really haven't honestly decided like who owns what. So how does that happen when developers want to start building stuff on the floor of the ocean? Here is the fascinating thing. You know, I went to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia to go scuba diving because that was one of the things on my bucket list. So I don't know. I've never been there. I just assumed the Great Barrier Reef is right off the shore of Africa, of Australia, because it's the Barrier Reef. It's in Australia. It must be. You go to the edge of the shore, and there's a reef out there, 500 feet or 1,000 feet or something, and then you could, that's the Great Barrier Reef. I didn't know what the hell it is, right? I've never been there. So I book a trip to go to the Great Barrier Reef. Well, I find out I need to stay on Hayman Island. So I take a speedboat to Hayman Island, and that's like an hour out in the ocean. I mean, a really choppy ocean. So you stay at this gorgeous resort in Hayman's Island, and then you take another boat to the Great Barrier Reef. The Great Barrier Reef is just in the middle of the ocean. I mean, to give you an idea how middle of the ocean it is, I was so queasy, because I get seasick, I was so queasy just getting to the Great Barrier Reef, I paid $2,000 and hired a helicopter to fly me back to my hotel when I was ready to go, just because I didn't want to take that boat ride again. Okay? But who owns that land? It's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So if we can now build on the floor of the ocean And now we pick a spot. If you take Hawaii, for instance, Hawaii is the furthest landmass from any other landmass anywhere on Earth. So if we pick a spot somewhere between California and Hawaii, and we create a resort on the floor of the ocean, who owns that? What country has jurisdiction there? How does that work? You know what? These are really messy problems. People who can solve those problems, people who can anticipate those problems, people who can anticipate the opportunities that those problems will solve, will create fortunes. Let's look at another trend I talk about in the book. This is a shocking, shocking, shocking percentage, a shocking, shocking, shocking number. Think about the percentage of the human diet in the developed world today. What percentage of that diet is fake food, fast food, frozen food, or microwave food? And I promise you, it is a mind-numbing percentage, no matter which country in the developed world you go to. Australia, UK, France, America, Canada, Germany, Malaysia, Russia, go anywhere. The percentage of fake fast food, frozen food, and microwave food is monumental. For a lot of people, it's 80, 85, 90, 95%. Big, big number of the people around the world. So now, what do we know? It looks like a linear trend. At some point, looks like a hard trend. It's been a hard trend for a couple of decades on the increase. At some point, it's going to go the other way. Why can we know that? Because we can also look at the trend that is following the fake food, fast food, frozen food, microwave food trend, which is the increase in diabetes, the increase in heart attacks, the increase in strokes, the increase in obesity, the increase in all degenerative diseases, which are caused by the fact that the vast majority of food we eat is either fake food, it's frozen with the nutrients gone, it's microwaved with the nutrients zapped out. It's fast food, which is high caloric, high fat, low nutritional, very unhealthy stuff. So all these degenerative diseases will continue to increase and increase and increase. Now go back to the prosperity consciousness of this. Here's the thing. We create these – uh-oh, Bob Berg's getting nervous already because he's afraid I'm going to start talking about donuts. He's like – he's like the biggest Dunkin' Donut consumer in America, I think. What is donuts? Donuts are fake food, right? They're not real food. And don't get me wrong, now I'm not a Dunkin' guy, but, you know, I live in Miami where we have the original Krispy Kreme, where they have that neon sign that starts flashing hot donuts now. When I'm driving by there and that sign, I have alignment issues with my car, right? But I'm not crazy enough to think that's real food. I know it's not real food. It's just pure sugar. You put one of those glazed chocolate donuts in your mouth from Krispy Kreme and it's gone in about 2 seconds. So now, of course, I try to eat healthy. I exercise, I do, and I have my guilty pleasure. Some things that I might have now and then, like a Krispy Kreme or a Dr. Pepper or Pizza Hut or whatever. But for the vast majority of people, this is such a huge 80, 85, 90, 95% of their diet, and this is going to create some really daunting challenges for a society because of the heart attacks and stroke and obesity and hospitalization and degenerative diseases and all of those things that we're talking about. But again, we assign subjective value to this stuff. So you're driving along, you get a flat tire, you assign a subjective value that's bad. But for the guy who owns the tire store, he assigns a subjective value that's good. Now, it's the same circumstance, but two different people assign two different values. You don't like it because you got to buy a new tire. The guy with the tire store likes it because you have to buy a new tire and he gets the money and he's got to send his daughter to college. So it's the same here. So, you know, if you're in the wellness business, if you're in the nutrition business, if you're a chiropractor, iridologist, massage therapist, you sell health foods, healthy restaurant, and you got to look every time they're building a new McDonald's, every time they're building a new Taco Bell, you got to say, this is my annuity. This is money in the bank for me. Because at some point, there will become such a breakdown that people will have to go the other way. And there will be fortunes to be made by people who offer healthy alternatives. Look at another trend around the world. Black people are mating with white people. Spanish people are mating with black people. Asian people are mating with Latin people. Africans are mating with Europeans. Europeans are mating with South Americans, are mating with Asians. We are going to become one large planet of brown people. The geography, the lines, the nationalities, the ethnicities, all of these delineation lines and means which we assign, the labels we assign to kind of keep track of things, they're going to disappear. And that's going to create problems. I know I heard we had somebody on from Hawaii. Well, you see this in Hawaii, right? There's a movement there to preserve the Hawaiian heritage. There's a movement to preserve. There's very, very few people who speak the Hawaiian language anymore. And you can see the same thing in France. There's a big movement to protect French heritage. There was somebody drove a tractor into the first McDonald's they built over there because they saw this as the American imperialism taking over their culture. And you're going to see that all over the world. There's going to be people really threatened by that. There's people really threatened by that in the United States right now. You know, there's a big, you look at the Tea Party thing, there's a lot of people in there that are fierce about English as the official language, and nobody should ever be able to speak another language, and no ballots, no government assistance, no nothing should ever be provided in any language except the language of the country. We'll take that now and multiply it by 220 different countries around the world, and you're going to see the kind of challenges that's going to create, and ask yourself, what could I do to solve some of those problems? Those are challenges that are going to come up. How do I help people with that? Oh, really? So I'm just seeing New York and New Jersey were battling over who owned Ellis Island. Imagine that. Wow, fascinating. All right, so here's something else I talk in the book I think is really a mega trend going on. The retail model, it's broken. This is a broken model that started, it's the same model they were operating on 250 years ago. Back then, stuff was made in the old world, meaning England. It went on a boat to the new world, meaning the United States, docked at ports like Baltimore or New York or Boston or wherever, went by stagecoach across the country, went to a general store, and then the population, the consumers came in and bought these products at the general store. Now we're 2.5 centuries later, and the same business model, if not worse, is being used in retail marketing today. So the ships have turned into airplanes, and the stagecoaches have turned into trains, and then the trains turned into 18-wheelers, and the general store turned into the family store, and the family store turned into the department store, and the department store turned into the mega mall. But it's the same basic model for 250 years. And I would argue that, in fact, it's actually gotten worse. That there's more complexity there, and there is more rack jobbers and wholesalers and warehousers and parasites in the middle between the manufacturer of the product and the end consumer. So this is a very strong trend that we've seen going on very heavy for a couple of decades now. It's not a coincidence that Home Depot went bankrupt, that Macy's went bankrupt, that Sound Advice, when all those big chain, big box stores went bankrupt. You know, think how many massive major retailers are bankrupt, went bankrupt, or about to go bankrupt. That's not a coincidence. It's the fact that they're still trying to operate with the same model that people were operating on 240 or 50 years ago. And you know what? Though everything has changed. I mean, that's really what the premise of Risky is the New Safe is that all the rules are different. And, you know, if you didn't order the book yet, make sure you do that at riskyisthenewsafe.com. Pre-order it, and that'll make sure that you get the first edition copy, the first printing. As soon as it comes off the press, it'll be shipped out right away. You can get one of the first ones. Do that at riskyisthenewsafe.com. But so in the book, I'm looking at, okay, here's this crazy business, retail, where they're still trying to do business the same way they were 240 years ago. I mean, how many other businesses, how many other industries do you know that is still doing business the same way they were 240 or 250 years ago? It's just craziness. So think about, where is that going to go? Well, that market share is going to go to two different places. One is online marketing, and two is network marketing. So say, now, online market, everybody thinks that's big. I mean, every Christmas they're going to say, wow, the online sales set a new record this year. There were so many billions of dollars done in online holiday shopping. Here's the thing I want you to understand. We are not one millionth of where we're going to be for online commerce, online retailing, even 10 years from now. Let me say that one more time. We're not even one millionth of a percentage of what the online retailing will be even 10 years from now. There will be so much market share transferred from retail businesses to online marketing. We're talking literally in the trillions of dollars. So think about that. And there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed there, because there's social proof, there's community, there's the human tendency to gather in herds and see other people, and we like social proof when we buy things. So these are very difficult issues that online retailers have to deal with. Trust, the difference. You know, I literally came, I went to Home Depot before I did this teleseminar, because I wanted a new plant for my office. And so on the way to dinner, I stopped at Home Depot, and they had a checkout. It's a self-service checkout. You go and you scan your products yourself, and you swipe your credit card. And, of course, it didn't work. And, of course, the clerk had to come over and help me out because the machine doesn't work. But that's going to work more and more and more. And, of course, it's going to be more and more online. So it's a real serious challenge for people who are in the retail space to say, okay, how do we migrate with the online space and still give the customer service, still give that community, still give that connection? Now, that's where I think you're going to see a huge migration into network marketing. Because think of some of the issues we talked about last week, the millions of jobs that will be eliminated by technology, the millions of jobs that will be eliminated because of bankrupt governments and currency, the millions of jobs that will need complete rechanging because all the rules have changed. I mean, you could be a heart surgeon right now, and you went to school for 15 years, and you've been practicing for 20 years. But 10 years from now, you're going to be obsolete if you don't get retrained, because open-heart surgery is going to be done with a joystick out of a control room. And so the guy who's been doing it for 30 years right now, he's going to have to be completely retrained. So there's going to be millions. That's just one example of thousands of different jobs and occupations. So you're going to have millions of people who are also going to need complete retraining just to keep in the profession that they're in right now. So what I think is going to happen, one of the things I suggest in the book, is we're about to enter the golden era of network marketing. I believe, and if you've ever been to a network marketing meeting, if you ever went to an Amway meeting or an Herbalife meeting or a Nu Skin meeting or any one of those, you know, they always have this chart, and they show the exponential growth curve. And you have this formative years where companies get established, and then you have this tipping point where they go into exponential growth, and the curve is almost straight up, right? And then it stabilizes, and you reach a maturity stage. With that exponential growth, every company talks about that, every company strives for that. I believe the whole profession of network marketing is going to enter this golden era. And what I suggest, what I predict, is 30 years from now, 40 years from now, we're going to look back at 2013, 2014, 15, and 16 and say, this was the golden era of network marketing. I believe there will be months that literally 5 million people, 7 million people, 10 million new people will join the network marketing or direct selling businesses. and a lot of other home-based businesses, by the way. I think you see a lot more home-based entrepreneurs just because of some very strong trends where there's going to be millions of people who recognize their company is not going to protect them. Their company cannot provide for their retirement. Look at anybody who's in the airline industry right now. Look at, you know, what people happened to their 401k plans when the dot-com bubble. Look at what happened to people who were heavily invested in leverage in real estate. There's people who saw their whole portfolio wiped out 50, 60, 70% at the, you know, snap of a finger. So there's millions of people going to be on a monthly basis who will be considering businesses like network marketing and direct selling. That's going to be a huge, huge shift in the workforce, in the economy, in the marketing world, in the retailing world. It's going to take a lot of, because you look at network marketing, it's perfectly designed for the new economy because you have this manufacturer who makes a product, ships it to their distributors, who in many cases are the end consumer, and then they're conversationally marketing it and using social media to their friends, acquaintances, neighbors, family members. And if you haven't been on Facebook, you know, if you don't know this, you haven't been on Facebook in the last 2 years. It's huge, right? And it's getting bigger, bigger, bigger. And I think we're about to enter this golden era. That's one of those trends that, again, you get in front of that trend, you can make a fortune. Let's talk about something else. You know, last time we talked about this overload of information. Joaquin was on the teleseminar last week, and I was telling the story of when we all met for dinner, and he, you know, he had his iPad and his BlackBerry and his iPhone and a disk drive in his pocket just to go to dinner. And he's, you know, that's what everybody's doing. I mean, we are the most connected, the most techno society, the most on-call 24-hour society ever. So we are assaulted with more information than a human being has ever had to process in human history, ever. I mean, you process more information in a day today than your grandparents used to process in 5 years. Just think about what you get on your Google feed and your Yahoo page and your homepage and your Twitter feed and your Facebook stream and the cable news networks and all of the billboards and all of the advertising and all of the SMS text messages. And all. You are processing more information in a day than your grandparents processed in years. This is creating an ADD, overloaded, overwhelmed generation. What is that going to cause? It's going to cause a lot of challenges. It's going to cause a lot of learning challenges. We're in such a situation. So if you're a speaker or a coach like Dave Carpenter, who introduced me, think of what are the opportunities of how people learn. If you're a textbook manufacturer, first of all, you got to say, well, is anybody ever going to buy a physical book anymore? How does that change? Where do we go with e-books? And then we say, well, what's the next thing is, how do we go with how people learn and how that changes? If you're a university, I gave some examples in the book of what High Point University is doing that a lot of the Ivy Leagues are not doing and why they're hastening their irrelevance. You know, we're rapidly coming to a time where a six-month certification from some online course will be much more lucrative to somebody than having an MBA or even a PhD. Because if that six-month certification is in something like gaming, video gaming programming, spaceship piloting, spaceship navigation, those kind of things, it'll be worth a lot more than somebody who spent 10 years or 15 years getting a PhD. So how do universities deal with that? This is going to be a big problem with them. How do teachers teach? How well professors teach? How Carlson Learning, Isaac, if you're listening to this, how is Carlson Learning Corporation, University of Phoenix, how are they going to have to change what they do? What's your local community college and university, the teachers, the professors, the speakers, the coaches, the consultants? me, what I do, all of the people with the blogs and YouTube channels, how do we deal with the fact of the attention deficit disorder, the fact that people are overwhelmed, the fact that people are overloaded, that the how they process information, the shortening of their attention spans? Take that further to the publishing model. You know, I call this a book because that's the label everyone knows, right? It says book. It's published by Wiley & Son New York. But risky, once you get it, you're going to see when you open up that first page and you get to the title page, it says risky is the new safe, a rock opera in four acts. Because I just changed the model. Because, again, I looked at this when I was writing this book, as I was thinking about writing the book. I looked and I said, what is going on in the publishing profession? What is going on there? There is, 99% of all the books that are published today lose money. And they make so much money off the Harry Potters and the Chicken Soups for the Soul and the whatever. That 1%, they actually make enough money off the blockbuster 1% that it covers the 99% that lose money. But that's crazy. I mean, the best-run publishers like lose money on 97% of the books they put out. And the number of books getting printed is going down. The number of books getting read is down. The number of books getting sold is down. So I looked at this and I said, you know, I don't think the publishing model is working very well. So I'm just going to blow it up. I always wanted to write an opera. I'm going to write a rock opera. Risky is the new safe. And so the opera took shape, and it was four acts, and I have a tenor aria, and I have a soprano aria, and that's how it came together. And then when I was fighting with my publisher, and yes, I was fighting with my publisher all the time, I would just say, well, it's not a book. It's a rock opera. You know, it's when you see the book, and you see, if you go to riskyisthenewsafe.com and you look on there, you see, I mean, between Larry Winget and Harv Eker and Brian Tracy and Joe Calloway and Ian Percy and, Bob Berg and so many thought leaders who gave me just over-the-moon testimonials from that. So, I sent them all to the publisher, and they call me and they say, well, wow, these are amazing. We have never had a book with so many testimonials. We've never had a book with so many big-name testimonials. These are amazing. How many do you want to use? And, of course, I said, all of them. Like, all of them? That'd be like 14 pages. I'm like, yeah, what's your point? Well, that isn't, we just don't normally do that with books. You know, we pick the top four or five or seven, but, you know, that's how we do it. And I'm, how's that working out for you? Doesn't look to me like the publishing business is working very well. So since that doesn't work very well, why don't we do something different that I think will work better? You know, the subtitle, the cover, everything. You know, I'd get these calls from New York, and they'd say, well, we just don't normally do that with books. And I'd say, great, because this isn't a book. It's a rock opera. And so they didn't really, they're like, okay, you know, you're so crazy. You're so whacked out. We've never had anyone like you. Nobody's ever done anything like this. And to their credit of Wiley & Sons, they went along with it. They just said, you know what, this Gage guy is nuts, but he's nuts in a good way, and he's doing something bold, daring, imaginative, and different. And you know what? It's going to work. And you can see the buzz for the book, the advanced sales for the books. This is already a bestseller. It hasn't even come out yet. It's already a bestseller. This has already been sold. We sold the 10th language yesterday. We sold, Romanian yesterday. Okay. Normally, you can't even sell those until it gets published in English. If it starts there, you get it out in English, and then other foreign publishers look at this. We've already sold 10 languages, even though we sold it before. I sold six of them before I'd even written the book, based on the concept of the book. So what's the lesson for you? What is the thing you could do different? What are the rules that you need to break? First of all the rules have changed. Second thing to keep in mind is you can break any rule as long as you know why you're breaking it. And same thing, if we look at the publishing model, we can take that forward to newspapers. Yes, newspapers are going bankrupt all over the world, and newspapers are trying to figure out how do we do a paywall? Do we do this electronically? Well, you know what? there's a certain amount of people, and I'm one of them, that on a Sunday morning, I want to get a big, fat newspaper delivered on my doorstep, and I want to take that newspaper and get in my recliner chair in my bedroom and get a cup of green tea and maybe a toasted cinnamon raisin bagel and read the paper. Or I want to go to a coffee shop or a Starbucks on Sunday morning and read a newspaper. Now, the fascinating thing is most of the newspaper I won't read because I'm a prosperity guy and there's too much negativity there and I'm not interested in it. So, of course, I'm going to read the editorial stuff, the political stuff, because I'm a political junkie. Mainly, I get the paper to read the sports page because I'm a baseball fan. So I've got the baseball thing, and, of course, what day would be complete without a Dilbert cartoon, right? So I have these. So I get this paper delivered, this Sunday paper, which has 300 pages, of which 290 I don't read and I put immediately in the recycle bin in my condo. But wouldn't I pay for a home delivery RSS feed on Sunday morning if I got, well, my favorite columnist from the New York Times, and I want to get Jennifer Weigel from the Chicago Tribune, and I want to get Karen Putz at the Chicago Now thing, and I want to get Seth Godin's blog, and I want to get this. Could I put that together? Is that the future of newspaper? Is there something there? Can I get this in a pay thing? Can I get it in a tiered pay thing? Can I get it so I can get the paper thing delivered to my door and also get it delivered to my iPad or my tablet or my smartphone or whatever screen is in front of me? Where do we go with all this? We don't know. And here's the thing. I want to reinforce what I said last week. Rupert Murdoch doesn't know, and he's a billionaire. Mark Cuban doesn't know. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't know. Richard Branson doesn't know, and they're all billionaires too. Branson's going to be putting tourists in space, but he hasn't figured out how we're going to colonize the moon yet. He hasn't figured out who owns the asteroids yet because nobody's figured it out. These things, nobody's figured them out. And the people who do are going to create fortunes. So that's what I want you to get. If there's anything I want to get with you, it's that. Once again, if you haven't got the book, you got to get the book. Risky is the newsafe.com. Go to that page. I have a video there. I'll take you through the book chapter by chapter by chapter and show you exactly what it can do for you. But again, why did I write the book? It's this simple. We live in the greatest time in human history. Listen to me very carefully. There has never been a greater time to be alive. In human history, there has never been a greater time to create wealth in human history. Listen, 100 people better tweet that out right now. Hashtag RINS. There has never been a greater time to create wealth in human history. Do you get that? There has never been an easier time to go from broke to wealthy than it is right now. There has never been a better time to go from destitute to multimillionaire than it is right now. And perhaps, and very likely for some people, from destitute to multi-billionaire than right now. Yet millions of people around the world don't know that yet. Because they're watching the news, because they're reading the front page of the newspaper instead of the Dilbert section of the newspaper, they think we're living in the darkest time in human history. And they've bought into all these mind viruses. So I wrote Risky is the New Safe to reach those millions of people. And, you know, I've got a Jedi Council of people who are kind of promoting the book. A lot of them, I've seen their tweet now, and Christine Ellis and Kathy and Bob Berg and, you know, Kristen Bowen. And there's just a lot of people who have been supporting the book. But I'm asking everybody in the sound of my voice, whether you're in that Jedi Council or you just got on this teleseminar for the first time, this is information that we really have to get out to people. We have to spread this prosperity consciousness. And they got to realize, they got to stop buying into mind viruses, that this is their moment. This is their opportunity. Because of the internet, because of mobile, because, you know, I hope, David, I hope you're on here, my guy who did my Prosperity app. You know, we were exchanging some emails last night, and he was talking about, you know, he's wishing he was in some other, we were talking about opportunities, and he was like, well, I wish I was in another one of those more lucrative markets. And I'm like, dude, you're in mobile. You're in one of the greatest billion-dollar potential markets ever. It's like, really? And I sent him an email. Here's two multi-billion dollar ideas. I sent him back in the next email. And he's like, wow, I need to start thinking bigger. And of course he does it, like millions of other people. We need to get them thinking bigger. We need to expand the prosperity window through which they view the world so that they do what I was unable to do 15 or 20 years ago. So that when they see an opportunity, when that opportunity of a lifetime comes around 3 weeks from now, they'll actually recognize it and they'll actually act on it because they recognize it. And that's what we can do with the book. So I'm just, you know, I'm asking your help. After you get off this thing tonight, get on Facebook, get on Twitter, do a review as soon as Amazon takes them available. Make a little video on YouTube once you get the book. And, you know, just tell people about it. Even before the book comes out, if you could just tell people now on your Facebook page or whatever, hey, check this thing. I sent them to Risky as the new safe.com. Let them see the video, read the quotes, hear what the book is about, and they can make the decision right for them. But let's spread that consciousness. So, once again, thanks, Dave Carpenter. Thanks to my Jedi Council, everybody who promoted this. Thanks to everybody who's been participating on the Twitter chat. A lot of good stuff going on there, and I'm happy to see people connecting. I don't know if I'm going to have time to do another one of these before the book comes out. If I can, I will. There's still more interviews, you know, more stuff I want to talk about, but I've got a big, big conference in Orlando next week, and then I go Phoenix. We're having a Risky as the New Safe event there in Phoenix, October 16th. Follow my Facebook page if you don't have that. Then I go to Istanbul. Then I launch the book in Germany, and I have a live event in Germany. And then I come back. We're going to launch the book in Miami, October 29th. October 30th is the release date. We've got a big event in Dallas, October 31. We've got an event in November 13th in Boise, Idaho, and a big event in Calgary, Ontario on November 14th. So, and then I'm going to be in Orlando for the NSA chapter on November 17th, and I'll be talking about some of the same stuff there. So there'll be a lot of stuff. Watch my Facebook page, follow me on Twitter and all that. You'll know about all the events, and please spread the word to other people. So last thought before I sign off. I told you at the start, if you couldn't get 3, 4, 5 multi-million or multi-billion dollar ideas, you simply weren't paying attention. So think about that. Think about the things we talked about. This time, if you didn't hear it the last week, go back and play that and ask yourself, what's the multi-million dollar idea or multi-billion dollar idea for me? Thanks for being on, everybody. Peace. Love you guys. And live rich. Good night, everybody.